No, this is Paul and Nick, the Paul and Nick show, third episode. But Nick just asked me how the Australia trip was, and the trip was great. Met a lot of very interesting people, had wonderful hosts. The conference went well. It was recorded. We'll post it at some point. No, it was all good. It's just so now getting back, we had a delay getting back. Had an extra day in Melbourne with the airline had the emergency lights didn't work, and the plane we're supposed to take from Melbourne to Hawaii, and it's like, we're going over the Pacific. So what if the emergency lights don't work? If it's going down, baby, those emergency lights ain't going to help a lot. No, can't fly without them. And so wound up flying a day later, but it was all good. It was fine.
So. Nice. I gave you a little bit of scrunch on the getting back into your normal routine.
Yeah. That's just the way it goes. And then, of course, I didn't have a preacher lined up for the next Sunday. So then it's, all right, gotta get a sermon out quick and talk to people. And I'm way behind on email. And phone calls I have to return. It's just the way it always is coming back from being away. So yeah. I don't have elves that manage things for me while I'm gone. So it's, yeah, I didn't have to do all those normal things for a couple of weeks, but now they're all waiting, but that's just normal.
Still there for you.
Yeah. So how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. A couple minor things that happened in the last week. I backed into a car in my neighborhood. That was fun. My battery died in the same car, so trying to get that patched up and see if I can get a little bit more life out of it. But
yeah,
minor normal life stuff.
Yeah, normal things of life. Well, we ran out of time last time, and
we were
I just listened to the last, well, I was hurriedly setting up my little studio here in my son's room. I was like, do I go to work or do I do this here? It's like, I don't have time to go to work. I'll do this here. So you had your experience with the, and I'll just put a link to the second conversation that we did. You had your experience with the being of light. You had your ups and downs with diabetes. You got out of the pine cone company.
Yes. Oh, that was an interesting thing that happened recently too. On Friday, I ran into the owner.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And we had a very brief, we were in a very loud setting, so it was hard to have an actual conversation. But it was interesting. He went back in and started running the company again and got rid of the guy that I was having issues with.
Oh, wow.
Which was like a nice little confirmation, I guess, or don't know. Yep. I wasn't totally off the mark there.
yep.
But yeah, that was interesting. So we were right about to go into the Cult 4 experience.
Cult number 4.
Yes. And this one's probably the only way, you know. All the others were kind of, I showed up somewhere and it happened to be a cult that I then dealt with. Whereas this one I actually entered into consciously. And
why would you consciously enter into a cult?
They branded themselves as a cult.
Oh.
Which was certainly
unusual.
It forces a lot more. Yeah, it's unusual, first of all. It also forces a lot more conscious choice in what you're right. doing.
Truth in advertising. That's good.
Yeah. Well,
what do they, how did they advertise themselves as a cult, and what draws people to join them, or what drew you to join them?
So I've been thinking about how to structure this. It's a bit tricky because there's not much of a narrative, because there was no events, in a sense, mm-hmm. that I can kind of use as markers,
mm-hmm.
Just because it was all online. And mm-hmm. so it's just thousands of micro interactions. So it's a little bit harder for me to form a story out of it that is easy to communicate. I did want to spend a little bit more time kind of going over that burning hot phase, that, as I call it, just because I was kind of rushed at the end of the last one there. And that was a really important experience in my life. And that's kind of what set me down this, you know, divergent pathway, if you
will. Okay. So go ahead. Go ahead with your plan.
Cool. Yeah, I'll try. It's a lot less organized for this one, so we'll see if it ends up making sense or not. But I have a horrible list of notes that are terribly organized. So what I guess one of the parts I wanted to kind of hit on was the connection. And I thought it was interesting when I came across Peterson and he talked about burning off deadwood.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I had described this experience as burning very hot for a long time, you know, years before I ever came across Peterson. And I thought it was really interesting because I was like, oh, I know what that experience is, that he's this burning of deadwood. And that's what I feel like that's what triggered this experience, was going to that festival and realizing so much of what I had built my persona on was fake, for lack of a better word. And it created this oh, I need to like strip an enormous amount of my persona. And I mean, granted, it also, this burning of deadwood, I don't think he's talked about this much, but it really does, it produces an enormous amount of energy. You know, it's heat. It's a side effect of the getting rid of it. So yeah, and it, like he had said, you know, I forget which video it was in, but you know, you may find yourself burning away 99% of what you thought you were, or your persona in the in this process. And that was very much where I, you know, particularly when I cooled back down, it was like there was nothing there anymore. I didn't know what was left. And then I wanted to kind of expand a little bit on how I've tried to make sense of that experience. And you know, Verveke talks a bit about, and a lot of other people have referenced it, but the flow state. And probably the easiest way I could describe what that feeling was like is like a permanent flow state. So normally flow states are pretty hard to achieve and it requires a lot of variables to be kind of perfectly balanced with each other. So we kind of enter into it, say we're playing music and we get into the song and we kind of let go of ourselves into the music itself and we enter that flow state, or some activity or meditation or prayer.
Yeah.
This was like, I couldn't exit it. I couldn't go back to a
lower state of energy.
Yes, exactly. And yeah, so that's one way to think about it. And then kind of that transition I was experiencing with the being of light, like, and I wanted to tie this more deeply into what I saw with the ex that I talked about and her process, where it felt like she entered a burning hot phase. And then it led her down into this, you know, psychological issues.
Yeah.
And how I could feel myself doing that before this experience. And what it felt like was I was receiving a tremendous amount of energy coming in through the top end of the body. So like through, it almost felt like my eyes, right? I could see, that's how I describe it. I could see very clearly. And what it felt like was that the energy couldn't ground itself, couldn't exit the body. So as it was coming in, it was I was getting stuck in kind of solipsistic loops in my head, and I couldn't get rid of the energy fast enough that it, you know, it's hard experiences to describe. But I feel like that was what was like that kind of driving me crazy part. And, you know, in many ways, I feel like I just got lucky in that I found that if I submitted myself, that it allowed some amount of that energy to flow through the rest of me and exit. Mm-hmm. Whereas with her, you know, she didn't have a mechanism for that to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, there wasn't enough of a, honestly, a religious foundation or practices that you could, you know, people that have experienced these states had learned how to deal with them and how to, you know, integrate them really. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and that was the distinct feeling when I got the touch on the forehead, was like suddenly all the energy dropped down through my body. So it was building up in the head. And then upon that event, it was finally allowed to enter the, you know, lower parts of the body and flow out. You know, it's almost like ground, like when you get hit with electricity, right, in a sense, right? If you have a grounding, then it passes through you. But if you don't have a grounding, it all starts reverberating in the body and gets trapped, and then you burn to a crisp.
Well, is that true, or birds on the phone wire, they don't burn because they're not grounded? If it flows through you, then you have the conductive problem, right? If you create ground, if you're on an aluminum ladder on an electrical wire, then you're in real trouble because you're
actually connected to a
ground. That's right. And when you get hit with lightning, for example, it takes the electricity takes the shortest path possible to the ground. So it's, I understand the metaphor that you're using, but how it goes with electricity, I think, is actually a little different. And I'm sure someone in the comment section will correct the both of us. So
hopefully. Yeah. My understanding here is metaphorical at best, we should say.
But I understand what you're saying.
Okay, good. The other part of that experience I should touch on, and part of it, I was rushing through it because we were running out of time. And the other part was I wanted to, keep myself humble or stay in a state of humility. And in the process of doing that, I might've actually degraded that experience a little bit.
Okay.
Which I don't want to, make that mistake.
Okay.
But what it felt like was an overwhelming sense of love. And it's hard for me to use even that description, because when we say the word love, it's a loaded word, right? It's attached to so many things that weren't what this experience was like. Mm-hmm. And you know, I had watched the recent interview you did with Tim? Was it Tim or Tom?
Tim.
Yeah.
With the violin?
Yes, yes, yes. And how he was describing this oceanic experience of love. And that's, again, I'm trying to like break down an experience that happened in seconds that was so voluminous, you know, mm-hmm. that it's hard to parse it out linearly. Mm-hmm. But it suddenly Christianity and the mythological the structure of it, what it's trying to do to the person's subconscious, suddenly, you know, made a tremendous amount of sense. And like, for instance, a thing that had bothered me for ages about Christianity You know, again, without really having understood it or even made a solid attempt to try and understand it, was the concept of original sin, that you're born into sin, and then so you end up, by trying to reject that, you end up in a sense always trying to rationalize away your own sins, or your, you know, areas where you know you've messed up, and you start trying to load the world with the responsibility of your own actions, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it was this experience of overwhelming love and acceptance that actually gave me the bravery, in a sense, to be incriminated.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
That combination of allowing myself to admit and own my, take responsibility for my, what I knew to be wrong,
mm-hmm.
Combined with being absolutely accepted even in that wrongness, mm-hmm. was absolutely liberating,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
which was confusing, right? Because it always, to me, it always felt like accepting original sin was this heavy, you know, the opposite of a liberating experience. And mm-hmm. I was trying to go around liberating myself by blaming everything on, mm-hmm. on, you know, everything else.
Tim Keller has this saying, I don't have it quite right, but it basically amounts to you have to be happy in really, I think it's happy. It's really happy and secure in just the right way to basically be miserable in just the right way.
Yes.
And it's exactly that kind of putting things together that I am, you know, this has been done for me. And so it's secure to a degree that I now may engage and look at what should deeply bother me. I mean, you kind of need those two things together.
Exactly. Well, and you end up in like a chicken and egg problem too.
Yep.
And this actually, I don't know, I don't understand much about the different denominations of Christianity. Again, my personal route has been trying to make it personal. Mm-hmm. Which comes with all its, you know, mess ups and everything. But the Calvinist, what correct me if I'm wrong, but the Calvinist view of the kind of absolute sovereignty of God, or right, it's God that's saving you. You don't have the ability to do it on your own. And that, what I experienced was very much in line with that. Which is that, like, you can't start the process. You can ask for it, right? You can, like, open yourself up saying, I want this. But you yourself can't actually originate the place where you can even own your own, you know, your own responsibility or anything. It has to be given to you as a gift.
Yep. That's right.
And that's another part. It's like... we're incapable of loving God, in a sense. We're even more broadly, we're incapable of love altogether. We can channel the love that God has for the world, but we don't get to be the origination point of it. We don't get to be what creates it. And again, you end up in that chicken or egg problem. And that was the immediate experience, was like, it wasn't even my job to love God. It was the automatic reaction to being loved by God.
Right.
Like, I don't, you know, you don't have a choice in the matter. You just give it back. Right. Ugh.
No, and in fact, I was going to do a video this morning on Peterson at Liberty. And then another video came out with Peterson and more talk with David Nasser. And they got right to that point. That's kind of the point where the Calvinists and Arminians, which is actually a Calvinist heresy, according to Calvinists, but it's right at this point of, and it all has to circulate around agency and what it means for God to act in the world. And a lot of it depends on which perspective you come at it towards. And it's like you're not going to be able to get it right. So which side do you want to err on?
Yes.
And that tends to be the best we can do with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, and I noticed that, I mean, that's like what the difficulty is in trying to even explain the experience is you feel yourself making the error towards one side of the paradox.
Right.
And so you can't quite ever say what it actually is. It's very frustrating. But I'm assuming that's why people are still talking about this 1,000 years later.
That's right. Right? The ineffable, ironically, launches a river of words.
Yes.
Because yeah. You keep trying to articulate the ineffable, and by definition, you can't. And
can't, yes.
The Apostle Paul says similar things about his experience, his experience of drawn into heaven, as the Apostle Paul says. And, you know, words cannot, you know, that's...
Yeah, they stop working there.
They stop working. But still we must try, and that's what we do. No, you're exactly right.
And that's actually a fun... I've played around with that idea, but it's in a sense, it's highlighting poetry in a sense over knowledge, because our attempt now becomes a song, right? Much more so than it becomes a literal description.
Right.
Right. Right. It's us trying to honor the experience rather than us trying to grasp and know the experience.
Right. It gets into a ton of the stuff that we've been talking about in the Peterson conversation. Ian McGilchrist, in terms of the right brain and the left brain, it's essentially saying this is not something that this approach to language that is left brain, description, propositions, this cannot be contained in that. And it also gets into the thing that part of what we do with language when we use the word grasping is we, in a sense, we colonize it, but to grasp means to be able to employ. And a big part of this, it is that this is something we cannot employ.
Yes.
Now, we are employed by it.
By it, yes. It
deeply
yes.
disturbs us because yeah. we don't like that unless we submit to it. But, yeah. I mean, and so all of these issues that we have that theologians have been working on for a very, very long time, it's all there. And poetry more evokes... And song more evokes rather than this other use of language that we have, which is to employ. And, yes. and the point is, it can't be employed by us.
Us.
It's similar yeah. to the dilemma of the ring in Tolkien, where, you know, Barrymore yeah,
you
thinks...
You can't use it against its own creator.
That's right. You can't wield this.
Yeah.
And Gandalf has to wrestle with that, and Galadriel has to wrestle with that. And it's this limit that we have that we don't like. But yeah.
Absolutely. That's interesting. I had a thought and then it left my head. I always have that problem. It's so frustrating.
We all do.
I'm trying to get my spot back here.
Yep.
Oh, what I was gonna say is it's the tree of knowledge problem, eating the fruit from the tree of knowledge. It's playing on that same thing. And that's what's tricky about that experience of love is that it's extremely specific, right? It's infinitely giant, but it's also, right? It's like a universe, you know, the universe is endlessly enormous, but it's also extremely specific. Right. It forms itself into certain patterns and shapes.
Right.
Granted, we can't, in a sense, get outside of those patterns and shapes. But what this does is it makes it extremely enticing for us to try and codify the experience of love into a set of laws and rules so that we can emulate it without actually having to live it or experience it in a sense.
We might say we can reproduce it without having to receive it.
Yes. Yes. Except because that it doesn't actually work.
Exactly. and that is always the dilemma of love, is that it is given and received, but not taken. You taken. Can't
yes.
take yeah. love.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I can almost see then where, it, you know, in a sense, Christ becomes necessary because he's the living expression of it. It's not what Judaism had in a sense kind of crystallized itself at that point into these rules and laws. And you see that as like a tension between the figure of Christ and the Judaic system that he was operating in, where there, you know, he does a healing on Sunday, and then the Pharisees come and go, that's against the law. And it's like, well, what is the law you're following if it's not the active living expression of love?
Right.
So you...
And that's why Jesus keeps saying, they're saying, but the law not to heal on the Sabbath. And Jesus keeps saying, if you knew Moses, you would recognize me. And because the law is an articulation and an expression of that thing, but it can't, yes, you know, it can't contain the thing.
Yes.
It's,
yes,
again, it's similar to
codified.
Right. Your attempt to use words to try to express the thing, but your words can't contain or grasp or employ the thing.
Yes. And in a sense, even the attempt to codify it pulls you out of the experience.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you can't do both at once to some degree. Or at least that's how I experienced it. That the moment I actually used it as an escape from the experience to try and codify it. You know, I was obsessed with theoretical physics as a teenager. I mean, all the way to the degree that I taught myself calculus by reading the textbook when I was 14. Like, I was certain that I was going to be, you know, a theoretical physicist.
Yep.
And, you know, eventually I came to the realization that, or the way I described it was, you know, appropriating God for the sake of man's technology is not like a path.
That's right.
Take, right? I wanted the experience that made me so curious about the universe to begin with, mm-hmm, much more so than I wanted to be able to precisely describe it,
mm-hmm,
you know, codify it.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, when the experience was getting too intense, I was actually using physical theories to try and not only explain what I was experiencing, but to ground it in something, in a sense, to give me some relief from it. You know, it's a terrifying place living from there, especially when you feel it start to get sporadic and you feel it start to distort to some degree.
Well, and that, what you just described there, is you can find that expressed in interesting places. Charles Finney, for one, had this experience of God coming upon him, and he, you know, he asked to that God would relent. And you find this again and again in, you know, I hesitate to use the word mystical, because there's a tradition that in a sense employs that. And I'm not trying to critique that in any way, but again, we don't have words for these experiences, but the kinds of things you're describing are quite common in the literature.
Yeah.
And again, it's, and I think it's also connected with this idea that deeply bothers people, where God says, well, you can't see my face or you will die. But yes, to us, that just sounds, you're, you know, what game are you playing on me? But when you see it in the light of what you're describing, you begin to realize, no, I can't handle this in the way I can't handle a tornado or a hurricane, or these are things that are way beyond me. And, you know, so, and, you know, Moses and the cleft of the rock, there's a lot in the Bible about this. And again, the book of Revelation, where even when the messenger shows up, I mean, John just loses his stuff. And this happens. It's almost a ritual. Angel shows up. People lose their stuff. Angel says, be not afraid. And you almost want to say to the angel, we're kind of understanding it from this end now. Is this what it's like for us? But it's, you know, it could be that they just dial themselves down to the point where, okay, they're just at the, they're just at that liminal space, the there.
Threshold there. That's, yeah. Right.
Where, because if they, you know, like in when they show up, the three show up to Abraham, you know, they can obviously come incognito if they want to, but so there's just a ton here, and yeah, a lot of it's in the Bible. And
yes. Yes. And yeah, I mean, after that experience, of course, was when I first actually like legitimately opened a Bible and start. Granted, I didn't read the story through. I used it basically. This is probably my New Age leanings coming through, but I used it almost like a oracle or something. You know, I would ask before opening it, like, please show me something that I need right now.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
then I'd open it to a random spot and read what it was and then try and integrate it into what I was experiencing.
Plenty of non-New Age Christians do that all the time.
Okay, good.
Let me assure you, using the Bible as a magic eight ball, the lucky dip, some traditions call it. It happens a lot.
Okay, good. Not having never put myself in a formal tradition, it's hard to know how far on the heretic scale I'm going often, you know.
So. Don't worry, there are plenty of heretics in churches, believe me.
So that, yes, that's what I was dealing with, and I kind of ran through it with the job part, you know, because I was this was all happening over about a 2-month span, and that was the same thing when I first started. Well, first of all, when it finally could kind of flow through me in a sense, I could see it changing the people there and changing the workspace and everything. And I could feel them in a sense, like almost waiting to see, you know, like, can you stabilize this? Is this who you are now?
Yeah,
or is it gonna, and right as it started to distort and weird things started happening. And, you know, that's when they were like, oh, we need to put up a boundary, you know, like it's not stable enough to trust it.
Yeah.
Which was as far as I'm concerned, a good decision, because I wasn't, you know, able to stabilize that state.
Yeah.
And that leads me into cult 4, because what I saw with cult 4 was a person that had this experience and had integrated it far better than I had been able to, relax and stabilize it to a degree that I was incapable of. And in a sense, that's why I was like, oh, there's something here I need to learn. It, granted, also the timing of the events and how it all played out, kind of, it felt like I was like being pushed that way for some reason. And again, I didn't know if it was like, you know, probably not in a good way. I'm a proud person in that I don't like to follow others, you know, like I want to figure it all out myself, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I, even as I kind of entered into this, I kept a lot of that mentality where it's like, I'm either here to watch something, to witness something, mm-hmm, or to learn, or both, right? Maybe I need to learn certain parts and then be able to keep my discernment enough to know which parts to throw away.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And actually, you know, I mean, this is a recurring, as far as I can tell, a recurring story in the Bible as well, which is like, you know, the people God chooses can't stabilize that state either.
Right.
The only stable form of it you see is in Christ.
Right.
And everyone else, they get the huge, I mean, even Moses, right? It's like this huge flare-up of energy parts the sea and, you know, pulls the Jews from Egypt, and it's all these magnificent miracles taking place. And then he wanders the desert for 40 years and dies right before getting to his goal.
That's right. That's right. and lots of interesting little things in there where he strikes the rock when he's told to speak to it, and where he, you know, his face is shining. You talk about energy. His face is shining, and this so disturbs the people. You know, he veils it, but another tradition talking about, you know, veiling it because it was beginning to diminish. And, you know, there's a lot that goes on. Wow. In there.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting.
And yeah. And no, you're exactly right that we see, you know, we see this lived out in Christ perfectly, but yes. In the Bible, Christ is the only, you know, full example. Everyone else, like all of us, fits and starts, gets it wrong. I mean, yes. In the sense we're all on training wheels and we're toddlers in this.
Yes. Yes, that is precisely the feeling. Is, yeah. And it's almost that constant reminder of, like, you always have the inclination to start trying to control it yourself.
Yes.
And so it's like this regular process of submission. Yes. Over and over again. It's the moment, right? It's almost like the moment you see yourself trying, going off the path, the proper response should be, oh, of course I can't freaking control that, you know? Of course I can't handle a sun's worth of energy or a universe's worth of energy, you know? Like,
That's right.
My own self-concept is way too delicate a structure to be able to carry the weight of existence, you know?
That's right. When another human being insults us, we, you know, our lobsters get a little smaller.
Yes, absolutely.
Think we're going to take on the maker of the universe. It's like, whoa, naive can't begin to describe
it.
But that's how small we are. And this actually gets into, you know, the Orthodox tradition talks about this a lot. C.S. Lewis talks about how, you know, what God is, it is not just what God is preparing for us to be around, but what God is preparing for us to become.
Yes.
But again, just like we started out, this isn't something I'm going to sit real hard and I'm going to try this, nor is it something that I'm completely off the hook or completely irresponsible for. No, I am fully responsible.
Yeah.
But also, this is not something I can accomplish.
Yes.
And both those things are true at the same time, and we can't square that.
Yes. Yeah, the way I was describing it to myself was, you know, the thing God made is infinitely superior to the thing I could make out of what God made.
Yes.
And so it was almost this attempt to, again, it's both at once. You are taking absolute responsibility for you as part of the what was created, and yet you're giving it all away at the same time. And this actually pulled me into the idea of free will, and that in a sense there is no such thing as free will, because or rather the only choice free will has is what to give itself away to.
That's
right? That's the one choice that actually is free, is how do I give away my free will? To whom do I give it to? I could give it to myself, but then what I end up doing is following my own self-concept. Right? It's still not free just because I think it's contained inside of me. It's now operating on whatever, you know, mechanisms you might want to put it on, evolution or you know. And the greatest irony being, of course, giving the free will back to God is the only place seemingly where it actually feels free.
Yep. That's again, and if you read enough Christian literature, that's exactly the language that we use, that we give it back to God. And suddenly, see, it's like the word free is too big for us. But when we give it to God, the freedom there actually, because we're too small for it, then we actually begin to, and again, the words are hard, begin.
I know, they are.
Then suddenly it's in the right place.
Yes.
And that's why, you know, there is freedom in God, and people are always like, yeah, but the rules. No, but you don't.
Yeah,
you don't. It's really hard to just set down.
The rules are just how you naturally start acting through the experience of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the example of a universe being specific while also having infinite potential is definitely, I don't know, it's a way that it made sense to me. Yeah, I don't know. It's hard stuff to fit into words.
I think it's helpful for us to talk about and share, because these are the same places where theology, I mean, it's interesting now that the materialists, they're all hung up on free will, and they, in a sense, in the materialist framework, there's no space for free will.
Free will, yeah.
And if you see it from, by way of the conversation we've just had, it makes perfect sense. There's no space in free will because there's no space in us to employ that freedom. But yes. As the critique of the materialists is, well, they can't live out their doctrine because we can't help but exist within our framework without what we call free will. So then the question is, where does the freedom actually lie? And I think you've articulated that very well.
Yeah. And again, yeah, you're constantly finding, or at least I'm finding myself dancing on the two sides of a paradox in that attempt to explain it. And you see that exact same thing, ironically, with the hard materialists.
Yep. Yep.
I don't know. Materialism's a weird one.
It is. The consequence of working at home is my dog. My daughter's dog and my daughter's cat that hopefully once my daughter gets back from college, I get to, here are your animals, sweetheart. Care for them. Yeah, it's okay.
And another point of connection I wanted to make with the diabetes part of this story. Because, you know, some of the comments were like, of course, I expect a lot of this, but the it didn't feel like it was a spontaneous miracle healing or something like that. What it felt like was that the diabetes itself was coming from a self-rejection. That was, in a sense, I'd implanted in myself. And I think this was largely a response to the experience I had with my ex, where in many ways I had blamed myself for what had happened, or my inability to deal with it properly, or to help this person properly, or, you know, all those types of things. And the part that felt truly healing was not like necessarily it's tricky because what does the word miracle mean, you know, like, or miraculous, like why would you divorce it from the rest of the functioning of the systems in place, particularly as our own physical theories actually leave plenty of room for these types of events to occur.
That's I always kvetch when I hear people use the word supernatural, because it's we've just conjured up this framework, which I think is really of very little service to us, because there's an assumption there that is not really helping us. It's hurting
us. No. Well, and it's, again, it's like, it kind of made sense when we were first discovering physical theories that were very rigid in their formation. But once we get to a system like quantum physics, it makes no sense to separate every, you know, there's so many areas where it makes no sense to create even the concept of the supernatural as separate from the natural, right. Even in the creation of a universe to begin with. You know, isn't the fact that there's nature supernatural then? Like, it's a silly way to dichotomize, you know, right. events.
And this gets into, of course, Verveke's ongoing conversation about, you know, the Axial Age. And I think the wrong way to go is to say, okay, there is no top story. There's just the secular frame. And it's like, no, that doesn't really help us either. Because you have to cut out so much well-documented human experience historically, and you just simply have to dismiss it. And now you've just consigned yourself to a little iron box, and you're just not going to be able to live in it. And I think that's
no.
what you're saying.
No, yeah, that's exactly. And again, coming from my hyper secular iron box, it was precisely the reason I left it was like, oh, life is too much to fit in here. Like, it's a great tool.
Yes.
Like, don't throw away the tool, but also don't pretend the tool is all there.
Right.
There is. That's a very silly thing to do.
Right.
And it's not even concurrent with even the philosophy of science itself. You know, you're supposed to be looking at the information that doesn't fit. That's what makes it grow. You know? Like,
that's right.
Where are we at?
We've done it again, Nick.
Dang, I really meant to get to the rest of it.
Well, what should we do in this next 5 minutes?
I could try and run through some of Cult 4.
Okay. Give us a teaser. We'll talk again.
Yeah. It might be useful to talk again. I can try and connect some of it at least. Maybe like go through my why I entered. Okay. So yes, after I'd fallen back down in a sense, when I realized I could not keep this state stable, which again, even saying I could not keep this state stable, you can hear the error there already. But it wasn't my job to keep the state stable. But, you know, I had burnt off 99% of my personality. Granted, I'd received so much information and all this other stuff, but I didn't know what to do with it. So the way everything leaned, I figured, well, let me go see what this is. You know, let me go investigate what is happening here and take what I can from it and see what happens. And it was an interesting cult. So like a lot of the classic ideas people have around cults, right? No dissent is allowed and we've got our hyper specific thing and you have to cut off all your relationships to everyone you know in order to, you know, become properly indoctrinated. None of that existed here. Most of it was built off of arguing and fighting. Right, dissent was highly encouraged, and I often like to use the metaphor of an internal combustion engine as opposed to a steam engine. Right, the steam engine, it's the way it functions is by releasing that which gets too hot, you know, out into the outside world, and I think a lot of systems kind of function like that. You know, it's building energy within its cultic framework by kicking out the exhaust. Whereas we see a far more efficient system arise with the internal combustion engine, which is using those bright sparks, those, in a sense, dissent itself, to actually fuel the functioning of the system. You know, that's what's producing the energy that we're using to then, you know, propellers or whatever we're using the motor for. And you can keep going with that metaphor. I think it would be interesting to try and metaphorize nuclear fusion as, you know, an example of a hyper-efficient system. But I'm getting off the mark here. We only got a couple minutes. So yeah, again, it's hard for me to organize all of this just because it was such a bizarre experience. The place that it was acting in was a subculture of Facebook called Weird Facebook, which probably a lot of people don't even know it exists, but it's a pretty large network of people that are, in a sense, the counterculture. And most of the memes and everything that you see, a lot of actually the value of the system itself was coming from this weird little subculture. And the cult leader, you know, in a sense, viewed this as the prostitutes and the tax men of the modern, you know, it's in the streets, in a sense. You're not going to the Pharisees, you're going to and so, you know, a lot of it was like trolling people, using trolling as a psycho-spiritual technology, as Verveke might put it. And these are going to take too long to properly explain, so and I'm not well organized right now, so that might be, I know we pushed it twice now, but it might be a good spot for a final discussion.
Okay. Well, I thought our conversation on the ineffable was helpful. I enjoyed it at least.
Yeah, very much.
And I think others might. Why is it so hard to talk about the ineffable? By definition of the word, it's just the way it is.
The things you can't talk about. Well, why can't I talk about them?
Exactly. It's just like the things you can't see. Well, why can't I see it? Once you say, oh, yeah, I didn't want to see that. Yeah, okay. Now you can't see it, can you? There you go. Oh, we human beings are something else. But anyway, Nick, so sign up for another slot and we'll finally
finish that.
We'll get to it. It's okay. And someone once told me, he says, you should go like Joe Rogan. You should just have, you know, go 3-4 hours. I certainly could, but that's not the way I'm able to structure this. Joe Rogan invites his guests and I receive my guests, but I actually,
very different.
It's very different, but I think I've actually been quite blessed by receiving my conversation partners.
Yeah. And
the variety.
Find the hidden gems, if you will.
Well, that's exactly right, because the variety is just outstanding. And if I were directing the conversations, I couldn't do this because this gets into the same dynamic, because I'm too limited.
Yeah.
And, you know, we in our culture, the fad is that we talk about people as infinite. No, we're not infinite at all. We're pretty pretty repetitive and sometimes quite predictable. So it's when they get more of us that things get more interesting. So
yes, definitely. Oh, and right, that's that same thing. We might be able to channel something that is infinite, but we certainly don't get to say we're the thing that's infinite.
Exactly. Exactly. No, that's right. How small we are.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's great talking to you again, Nick. So sign up for another slot and we'll do this again.
Awesome. Sounds good, Paul. Great talking to you.
Take care.